There's so much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen may drink my wine, proud men dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. Know what any of it is worth. A little more Richie Havens. We'll go back to Richie Havens at the end of this hour and do a little reflection on him. But right now we're going to be joined by a panel, as I said, to talk about this this study that came out. Actually, nothing shocking in it in terms of what it said. I think most of us knew about it. But let me give us an example. It was talking about 54% of Maryland's black students, as I said earlier, were enrolled in schools where at least 90% of the kids were members of racial or ethnic minorities. In 2010. By that, again, I guess they meant people who weren't white, from a third in 1989. They specifically point out Prince George's County, where white enrollment decreased from 28% to 4% over the last 20 years. And that also is not kind of shocking. I mean, Prince George's County being the second wealthiest African-American suburb in the country, also is full of poverty and poor working people. So that also is a nature reality. And this was a Civil Rights Project report coming out. Gary Oldfield, who's co-director of that project, who's been on the show before, is quoted as saying, "We're seeing a lot of racial change, not much effort to do anything about it. What is one to do about it? And what should be done about it, if anything?" And we'll talk about this in a number of ways this hour. We're joined here in studio by Dr. Thurman Bridges, who is an associate professor of teacher education here at Morgan State University, and Kenneth Haynes, who is president of the Prince George's County Education Association, and Jeff Menzies, who is research associate at the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, a licensed school psychologist, and author of Dumbing Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro. And welcome to the three of you. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Good to have you all here. And let me get that mic closer to you, Thurman, so you can be heard.
Okay.
Good. There you go.
Good. Good.
There you go. And so this, and folks, join us here at 410-319-8888, because one of the things, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, log on to Facebook, and I'll look to see what you've written there, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, any way you'd like to get to us. We want to hear from you. 410-319-8888. So the question I have first is, what does this report say to the three of you, to all of us? The fact that they use the word segregation, because segregation was a legal term to segregate somebody legally from another, black folks in America not being allowed to go to school with white folks. So it's not legal segregation, but it's de facto, as people would say. Mm-hmm. And is that important or not? Is that an important issue, Jeff Menzies?
Hey, Mark, I appreciate the invitation. I believe it's absolutely an important issue, especially when we see that this segregation, quote-unquote segregation process, also has tagging along with it a serious degree of academic and educational oppression, meaning that when you have a school that is majority, quote-unquote minority, you also have a school that tends to suffer financially, suffers as far as the brain power is concerned, suffers as far as the apparent value system and the instructors and as well as the student population is concerned. So I think that's a very big, big issue. I think that we can strive, in all black institutions as we do at Morgan, as we do at Howard or Fisk University. But when there is an issue as far as economical justice, then I think we're talking big problem.
And Keith Haynes, is it a problem? Keith, you there? I mean, Kenneth? Kenneth, I'm sorry. Kenneth, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, so is it a problem?
With the de facto segregation itself, I don't find that to be too terrible. I've been teaching here my entire career. I'm much more concerned about the economic separation and funding for students. What has happened is that the local contribution to the Prince George's County Public Schools has fallen from 48% of the total budget to 39% over the last decade or so. And so so there's a wide economic divide in terms of opportunities that are offered to the students here. And so I see poverty more the issue than an issue of race at this point.
Thurman, how do you see it?
Well, in fact, I agree with the other participants. When I think about this idea of of segregation, de facto or in reality, it's not inconsistent with what schooling has been like throughout the history of this country since we've had public education. And so even after desegregation, quote unquote, schools were still, in fact, segregated. And so that reality isn't new. But what challenges me is that I think that the real conversation is not necessarily about racial segregation, but again, about poverty and achievement. And so if all black schools in certain areas equate to low academic achievement and low resources and low funding, then yes, it's a problem. But in and of itself, if this idea of segregated schools were a problem, then we would be having this conversation discussing the all white schools. And so it's more about resources and access and poverty than necessarily about race.
So before I get into the issues of poverty and some of the issues you raised, Jeff, about in some ways the comparison difference between HBCUs and all black institutions versus the issue of whether public schools that are virtually segregated, white or black or whatever they are, and the similarity or dissimilarity between those two presentations we'll come to in a minute. But the question I'm curious about, I mean, so what difference does it make to the students or the academics in those schools if schools are predominantly one race or ethnic group or the other? You know, you look at schools in this Baltimore area, let's say, like Hereford High School, which is in northern Baltimore County. The school is 90% white and is in a 90% white area. You go to a school in I'm just taking Baltimore County for an example for a moment. I could use any county. I could use Prince George's High School's area or anywhere else. You take a look at a school in the western part of Baltimore County, Randallstown or Woodlawn. These are both high schools which are predominantly African-American, and I'd say 90% or more of the students there are African-American. Or you have schools on the eastern part of the county, which is probably one of the few places in the whole metro region where there are really interracial schools. Towson, Delaney, some places in Dundalk and Easton Votech, and Carver, not Carver Votech in Baltimore, but Carver in the county. These are really integrated schools where there's, you know, where students from all kind of backgrounds go to. When you look at their scores, does it make a difference? Does it make a difference to their education? Does this make a difference? What do we think? Is it that? Go ahead, Mr. Thurman.
Does it make a difference? So, again, my issue is about my fundamental issue that divides my thinking about whether or not it makes an issue relates to, again, funding, access, et cetera. But if we were to really just examine the experiences or the lack of experiences that students and teachers and administrators have in schools that are racially homogenous, then therein lies what I believe are some of the challenges that exist. And so, you know, having a school that's all black, having a school that's all white predominantly, you fundamentally miss some key sort of perspectives, key gifts, key talents, key ways of thinking about the world that only a sort of a culturally heterogeneous environment could produce. And so what happens in schools that are racially monolithic is that there is a fundamental dearth, a lack, and a hole in sort of the social, academic, and sort of personal development of students and faculty in the school. So that's, to me, one of the sort of baseline sort of challenges is a lack of representation, a lack of perspective, and a lack of sort of a more a whole and sort of global view on how people exist in the world.
See, I think there
Jeff, go ahead.
There are a couple of things taking place here now. One is that we're assuming that an all-American African, all-black, all-African school is homogenous. I mean, you talk about the culture diversity on a campus like Morgan.
True.
I mean, you have people from Baltimore, you have people from D.C., you have people from California.
True.
Everybody is representing their own personal culture, so we do have diversity within these institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But I do agree that, you know, if there is, like, for example, a dumbing down of the perspective of the individuals, then we have big problems, especially if those individuals are in administration and faculty or teachers within that institution, whether we're talking elementary schools or universities.
Mm-hmm.
There is diversity that exists. And I wanted to make one more mention, Mark. I was thinking earlier about how we're talking about this class and its economic division. And what I'm seeing is that those may be the issues, but it just so happens that those class lines and the economic lines are drawn with colored pencils. So it still comes back to that racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in the Washington Post article, we see where we're dealing with a situation of white flight, you know,
mm-hmm.
where white folks are basically abandoning these schools. And the question begs to be asked is, why, when white people leave, do the resources go as well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I say facetiously, are they stealing them? Are the children taking the money? Are they taking the budgets with them? Of course, I'm joking, but where is it going?
Right.
This is amazing.
Kenneth?
I tell you, it's been kind of an interesting progression for me as a teacher here in Prince George's County. When I came to Prince George's County, we were in the middle of the busing, and there were people that said, no, we're not going to bus, and then we invented the magnet school. So it's been quite an evolution. But what ultimately happened is the white flight occurred. And once the white flight occurred, and we've got a very affluent black middle class here, and we eventually opened up a new high school, and the parents in the area that was going to feed that new high school came to the Board of Education and said, those children from across the railroad tracks aren't going to come to this school.
You're talking about black parents talking about other black students?
Talking about black students from the low rises that were a couple miles up the street.
Right.
And so that was like an eye-opening experience for me, because I said, my God, this isn't a race problem here. It's an economic problem, because our school and not their school. And so there's an economic divide occurring here that's showing up in the funding as people who can afford it take their children out of the public schools. And funding for the public schools is being driven by the fallen enrollment, and we're in a downward spiral economically in the public schools because of it, because people have lost a little bit of confidence in the public schools. We've always been a little bit underfunded since Governor Hughes instituted the 0.8% as his entire funding. And so there's been this downward spiral, and TRIM has had an effect, and it has it's not race anymore in Prince George's County. I really believe that in my heart. It's an economic divide.
Now that's really interesting. Let me ask you to jump in on this, because I know the work that is done at the Urban Research Institute here at Morgan State University, and it raises a real issue. I mean, it is true that when the schools were mostly white, then integrated some in both places like Baltimore City and Prince George's County,
right,
that white flight took place. When white folks split and went to the counties.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So what we're hearing now is a story saying that within the African-American world of Prince George's County, that mm-hmm. same thing is taking place, but it's completely class. So what's,
and I'm not sure that it wasn't always – that wasn't always part of the element anyway. It was – people are very good about saying, I want to educate my child.
Uh-huh.
It gets a little more iffy as soon as it's the child across the street.
Well, see, Mark, as I was saying earlier, man, is that even those economic lines are drawn with colored pencils. Okay, so like, for example, if you took a snapshot of a plantation, you know, when it just so happened to be the overseer, who happened to be African as well as, you know, just like the other enslaved Africans, you would say, whoa, look at that African enslaving and beating those other Africans. And so what happens is that the overseer is actually imitating the master class. And so I say it's the same thing taking place in the example that our brother just gave about PG County. yes, it, on the surface, it does appear to be, oh, my God, this can't be racism because what? These are black people talking about other black people now. Mm-hmm. When in fact, racism is so insidious that, you know, it will occupy the minds of people, and they won't even realize that that's their motivation and that's what the drive is.
So I'm sorry, I may interrupt. Finish what you're saying, Jeff. I'm sorry.
Okay. But just from that perspective, yes, I do agree that on the surface it appears to be something other than race because there are black people that, quote unquote, seem to be discriminating against other black people. But what I would say is that at the core of that desire, of that drive, would be a perspective or a perception of other black people that is very similar to the perspective or perception that white people have of black people. And I think they're just imitating it. And I think that they've just adopted it as their own with very little critical thought.
Well, let me push a little bit on that just for a second, just for the fun of it, the analytical fun of it. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. When I come to these calls, your thoughts. I'm curious about, you know, where your kids go to school, maybe if you're a student yourself, what you think of the schools being either all black or all white or mostly one or the other. Does that make a difference? Do you go to an interracial school? Do you think that makes a difference? Is class an issue? What do you think is and then we'll get into what this might be causing in our public school systems. 410-319-8888. I really want to hear your thoughts. But some people might argue, Jeff, and everybody, that while you're saying could be absolutely true about imitation and about kind of mimicking the master class, that what happens in a capitalist society like the United States of America is that there comes a point where whether you are white or African American or you're Puerto Rican or whoever you are, that a X number of people do join the quote-unquote ruling class, do join the upper middle class, do see that their interests are vested in someplace other than their ethnicity because they're vested in the money that they're making. They're vested in the class that they've become part of. And that with America, you've got this race and racism and slavery thrown in that confuses the entire issue, that changes it the way we look at things. So maybe it's not as simplistic as to say people are just mimicking.
Well, see, Mark, you can have somebody that's absolutely wealthy. You know, I can have Oprah's bank account, and if my African identity or my African center nature or my American African identity is intact and it's solid, then that class issue will not be an issue with me. And so, I think that the class piece is totally separate from a racial identity, a healthy racial identity. And I do know that there are wealthy African Americans, just like there are wealthy whites or European Americans or Native Americans or Asian Americans, what have you, that will not adhere to that class divide, but it's based on having a certain sense of racial identity.
So let me turn over to Kenneth before we come back to Thurman, then we are going to open the phones for you. Kenneth, what are your thoughts on what you're hearing?
these are thorny discussions that have to be had.
Yes.
If we're going to get there. I'm a 60s child who still tends to think that some of our conservative friends tend to look at poor people like it's their fault they're poor.
Yep.
And I grew up in poverty. I did not choose poverty. Poverty chose me. And so I've always been sensitive to that issue. And I think it's something that as a society, we're living a tale of two cities here. I call it a tale of two school systems. We do not have mediocre schools. We have the schools of the haves and the schools of the have-nots. Hmm. And until we get to that social justice issue that all children deserve a great opportunity for a good public school education, we're going to continue to have these problems for decades to come, because we're creating our own social problems by not giving every child, regardless of what they're born to, an equal opportunity to succeed in school.
Thurman, why don't you jump in here, and then we'll open the phones.
Sure. I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, this conversation and this, you know, this discussion really forces me and hopefully forces all of us to think about, you know, education for who and who gets access to the best. And so then we when we start to examine that, it's difficult to separate race and class. I mean, those two identities inherently are intersected in this country. And it's consistent with what, you know, the history of this country has shown. And so Again, I'm brought back to this idea of education for who and what type of education for whom. And so, you know, thinking about, I was just teaching a class today, and we were talking about, you know, the school to prison pipeline, the prison industrial complex, right? And so you think about the idea that lots in certain cities around the country, you know, the research says that prisons are built based on the academic performance of Black and Latino boys by the third and fourth grade. So we're talking about white flight and about race and about poverty, but when you get down to the core of it, you know, I'm still challenged with this question about who gets what type of education and what's the purpose of it. And at the bottom of the poll, it seems to be consistently youth of color and particularly Black and Latino males. It's hard to separate this race and class discussion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's fine. I want to get our callers in here, see what their thoughts are. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Andre. You're on the air. Andre, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Very well, welcome.
I have several comments, but I'm going to try to be as quickly as I can.
Okay.
And I believe, Mark, your question was, should it matter whether or not it's a majority Black school, majority Caucasian school, interracial, whatever.
Whatever it is.
And now, my point is, and this is someone who grew up in West Baltimore, went to a majority African-American high school, Edmondson High School, but later went to University of Maryland, College Park. So I've had a little bit of both.
Uh-huh.
But to answer your question, it shouldn't matter. I believe that you should be able to learn as well in a majority African-American school as you would in a majority white school. And unfortunately, and this is, again, my opinion, I'm just curious what your guests have to say, you only really hear this discussion when it comes to African-Americans. Let's be honest. You don't really hear, I haven't necessarily heard whites like, let's integrate, let's make sure that we need majority Blacks or Blacks in our school. You don't hear it, but you do hear it with African Americans. And unfortunately, I have an issue because what are we telling our kids? That in order to get a quality education, you have to be in a classroom with white students, 30%, 50% white students. And
there
I think that's the mentality that we get, especially in a city that I love, Baltimore City, that I love. But I've seen that mentality actually trickle down to other issues in Baltimore, politics and shopping, what lawyer they're going to get. But I think if you start at the early age, like, okay, well, you need to go to an integrated school. You need, like they did in the 60s and 70s, you need to be bused to a school that's some white. And that's only we're the only ones that really actually have that conversation. And I just have an issue with it. I think, but statistically, facts are facts. The African American schools in Baltimore, PG County, routinely and consistently do, I guess, the worst in testing and things of that. And unless it's like a poly or a city or something like that, but Edmondson, Northwestern, they consistently test poorly. They have, but the problem with that is politics. We got politicians in Annapolis that are more concerned about pit bulls than they are about educating our kids and funding our schools, and I think that's a big problem right there.
So let's pick up what you said, because that's why I raised the issue of earlier, and I'm going to come back to the class issue here, because I think it's important. I'm not going to leave that. But earlier when we talked about Baltimore County schools and Hereford High School being almost 90% white, is that a problem for the white kids at Hereford High School? Is it a problem of the Black kids at Woodlawn, where it's 95% African-American? And that's the issue. Is that a problem? Should we be doing what they're doing in Memphis, which is negotiating between the Memphis City Schools and the county surrounding it to give students a choice to go to whatever school they want so the schools become more interracial? Is that an important step or not? Kenneth?
We're in an ideal world, I would hope that we could all live together and figure this out. But I don't know logistically how we could do that in Prince George's County right now. It would take an interjurisdictional busing plan.
Which is, yeah, that's right.
Because I don't think that's going to happen. But we're at a stage now where we're a majority-minority. I don't hold me to these numbers, but it's, I think, 60% Black, 25-30% Hispanic,
and then another 5 to 10% of God knows. But we are cosmopolitan here, and there is variety. And you go into the high school where I taught, there's 100 languages spoken.
Wow.
And so, in an ideal world, I would hope that eventually we get there. I'm just not sure logistically how it would be done to do that. And so I say that if this exists, as and it does exist as we sit right now, we have a majority-minority school system. So my complaint is we're still not putting the funding behind it to make Dr. Thornton's dream come true, which was that every child's going to sit in a well-equipped classroom with a highly qualified teacher. We're not funded at a point where we can do that and not. I've got classes in tested areas that are 40 and up. That's not right. Class size, whether the state wants to recognize it or not, class size is a working condition. And I've got people with 35 to 50 in a classroom in a tested area, and that teacher's not going to get the same job done as somebody in a Tony suburb that's got 24.
Amen. We have to take a little break. We're going to come right back and pick all this up.
Okay.
And go to our callers as well. And so stay with us. We're going to go out with a little bit more. Are we going out or coming in? Little Richie Havens. And we'll be back for a conversation about education and race.
Since the first time I saw you, flowers grow around my door. I never seen that rose before, and now that rose means so much more. Must be you it's growing for, 'cause you're a wonder child, living in a world that's all surprise. You make me see things through your eyes. Send it to. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny skies that I thought would never end.
Richie Havens, celebrate that golden soul who left us, and I'll talk about him at the end of the hour. He was a golden soul who I knew very well, and not very well, but knew, and he's missed because he was a wonderful human being. But anyway, we're here talking about race and class segregation in Maryland public schools as a result of the Washington Post article, but not a result of that, because it's an important issue to wrestle with, and we have three educators here wrestling with it with us. Dr. Thurman Bridges, Associate Professor of Teacher Education here at Morgan State University, Kenneth Haynes, who is President of the Prince George's County Education Association, Dr. Jeff Menzies, who is Research Associate at the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, and a licensed school psychologist and author of Dumb and Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro, and you at 410-319-8888. Before I jump into the questions that I want to bring back up that I was talking to Thurman about during the break, let's go to the phones, because people have been waiting in to get in this conversation. And Rob in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
I'm always love you, Robbie.
Rob, you're on the air. Rob, you there?
What do you think? No. Let me tell you something.
Guys. Rob, if you're going to join us, you got to join us.
And now.
All right. Let's go to Ernest in West Baltimore. You're on the air. Ernest, you're on the air. You there?
Yeah.
You're
Ernest. I find it different when a school has a terrific program like the Baltimore School for the Arts. Mm-hmm. They have black kids, black teachers, and white teachers, straight and gay. And they're about perfection, education, academics, top of the line, and your discipline, whether it's music, dancing, visual arts, or other things. Children, white children come from all over the state to get into Baltimore School for the Arts, which is an inner city school.
Right.
None of black children go there. In the Twigs program, that's for little children, just for Baltimore City. White children that live in Baltimore City and black children, they come from all over Baltimore City to get into that Twigs program because they know they're going to learn an instrument. They got highly professional teachers, conservatory-trained or college-trained musicians, most of them with undergrad or doctorate degrees. So when you have a situation like that, you know, children are going to go. The parents don't care what race you are, as long as their child is getting what they deem is necessary. Even at Dunbar High School, where Charles Fung is the music teacher over there.
Yeah, yes, yes.
In the summertime and in the wintertime, he used to have children that come over from the county, white children, so that they could learn jazz. Didn't even go to the school, but he was willing to teach and help them so that they could learn their craft. I was surprised at that, but this is the type of guy he is. And in music all over, people are interested in your craft. How do you play?
Right.
Things like this. Mm-hmm. They don't care what color you are, per se. Mm-hmm. You know, even at the Haven Lounge, I know you've been to the Haven Lounge.
Many times, when it was good, yeah.
Yeah, when it was good, when they had jazz out there.
Right.
You had white
fathers
and mothers bringing their children that wanted to learn jazz. They would bring them into that club and sit there with a whole lot of black people. So that their children could understand how the music should sound and how it's played, and so they would have an example of that. So I would imagine, even now Peabody's the same way. So if you putting out a project and your children is going to be educated, and you have a record behind you at the School for the Arts, 98% of their children go to college and are successful. So. I mean, and it's no test to get in there. All you have to do is audition.
And you have to pass the audition. Ernest, you raised an important point. I didn't have to hang up on Ernest. But Ernest has a strong point, and I just kind of let's jump into that a minute. I mean, this is the question of whether class and racial integration are critical to success of all students, no matter who they are. And which is part of the magnet school idea, which doesn't always work that way, but that's part of the idea. And so, Kenneth, jump on that first.
I would just say, where logistically possible, it's desirable. I'm not sure that it's always logistically possible.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think it is important. You know, diversity is a very powerful experience. It's a very powerful concept, and when at all possible, if it can be entertained in a very healthy and mutually beneficial manner, I say go for it. But I don't want it to lose sight and believe that because people are willing to come and listen to your music or come and learn from you, and in that instance, they would disregard the race of the individual instructor, that the problem doesn't exist. I mean, the white flight exemplifies that. And if I can, real quick, it was the earlier caller brought up a very powerful point. I don't want us to lose it. Now.
Go ahead. What was that?
He talked about how there's a subtle message being delivered to American African children, the black children, that says that if our schools, if they don't contain a certain number of white people, then our schools aren't worth going to. Our schools are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a part of that insidious nature. It's like when you see a black community boarded up. The houses are boarded up. People are on the corners nodding off. It seems to be a function of those people in that community, those people in that school. and not the bigger picture of what's actually taking place. And so I just wanted to echo his point and just kind of salute the fact that he put that out there. That it does send a very slick and subtle message that African-American, Americanized black folks don't seem to be competent enough to run their own schools and to keep them above par.
That's a dangerous thing to bring up to the guy from Prince George's County right now.
What do you mean?
With the executive takeover this last month.
Right. it is. I think that's so when you just before we turn back to Thurman and go to our next caller, expound that a little bit, Ken. Why is it dangerous? I mean, how is what's happening in Prince George's County affecting schools in terms of what we're talking about here in this conversation?
Well, I think the part of the issue there is we really don't know. I've got a stack of studies on my desk to read. I haven't read them all yet. But I'm looking for some place where an executive takeover has actually improved student achievement over time. And the best I see is a couple studies that say there's a blip when they hire the new guy, whoever it is. But there's usually a year or two blip, and then they kind of get lost in the melee. We just don't see any evidence down here that executive takeovers work in terms of really improving life for students in the classroom. And if I could find one, I'd be willing to have the discussion with you, because I'm always in my entire career been 100% about let's make the right decisions for kids. But we don't see any evidence of that.
Thurman, you want to leap in before we move to it?
Oh, sure, yeah. So I kind of agree with Kenneth when he spoke about the message that's sent when you sort of create this dichotomy, this black-white dichotomy. You know, when you think about this conversation around the achievement gap, you know, essentially we're discussing the poor performance of black students, right? But embedded in this idea of a gap is this comparison to white students. And so, you know, in reference to the message that it sends, there is a sort of consistent message for black youth or youth of color when compared to white students in reference to this gap, or when we're addressing the fact that PG County is predominantly black, but we're not really deeply examining, predominantly white school districts and the impact that could have on their students, that this fundamental comparison to whiteness is problematic. And I mean, in reality, white students aren't doing so well in the U.S. compared to students globally. And so that in and of itself sends this message.
And I need to jump in on that one, because we've got, we keep hearing in the press these American schools are mediocre.
Sure.
And that is really, really not the case. It's like you're walking into the hotel and you've got the retired jockeys and the retired NBA players, and you're saying that the population's of average height. It doesn't work as an analogy, because we have the schools of the haves that compare favorably with everybody across this world, and then you've got the schools of the have-nots that don't so much, and we take the figures and we call them average, and we're really not an average school system in the United States.
Sure, but my point still remains this comparison as it relates to students of color, particularly black students, and this gap, or these school system-wide comparisons are fundamentally problematic for me.
So let me raise an issue that I raised during the break with Thurman Bridges, and it's this: we're pushing the class race things just a tad further. One of the things I said was that to Thurman and Jeff, I'll let you jump in on this first. Is that if you look around right now at our Baltimore City, private schools in the metro area here, there's a growing population of African-American students in those private schools. I'm talking about the all-white prep schools of Gilman and Friends, and just name them, Park. There are large numbers of communities of color in those schools. And when I was hearing what Kenneth was saying about the new school being built in Prince George's County, where upper middle class black parents did not want their kids going to that school, one of the things I thought about immediately and said to Thurman was that middle class and upper middle class parents, period, see kids from the street and from poor working class and poor communities as dangerous. Let's say, well, they are. And I'm not saying people are. That's perception, A. And B, that during the time of segregation, black culture really was embedded in black neighborhoods. It was embedded beyond class.
Yeah.
But what's happened now in some ways is that in the poorest working class districts in the black community, what people call black culture, I've said before, is prison culture masking itself as black culture, and people are running from that.
Wow.
So I just, your thoughts.
Mm.
I know, Jeff, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree as far as the, there's been a swift and very deeply penetrating change in what we consider to be black culture, African-American, American-African cultures. And as you say, I echo your sentiments about prison culture masquerading as, you know, hip-hop culture masquerading as black culture.
Well, I didn't say hip-hop culture.
I know you didn't. I'm
no,
mad at
yeah,
that part.
I'm not saying that. Okay,
Because so much of what our youth, because we're talking about education, so much of what they perceive to be their own or what they take on or adopt to be their own personal culture comes from popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see many cultures more popular right now than hip-hop culture.
True.
You know, being in the classroom and being in academia and institutions, I mean, I walked past kids today and they saw me dressed in all white and they said, all white, everything. Immediately, I'm like, okay, there must be a song out now that says that. I know this one that says all gold, everything, but they had these other lyrics, so I got to find it. And what I find is that the culture, quote-unquote culture of hip-hop, it carries so much of the prison culture with it. Mm-hmm. And I say prison culture in the sense that it represents the persona that comes out of prison for some people, and it also represents the attitude and behaviors that will land you in prison for other people. And so with that, I see it's a slow, and well, it's slow, but it's swift still, and it's a deeply penetrating shift, and it's gobbling people up. And so I do agree that when upper-class people are people that are, quote-unquote, culturally distant, distant from, I guess, what we would call the grassroots culture, in quotation marks, they would perceive a group of young men walking down the street looking like rappers as dangerous. Like you said, not saying that they are, but the perception would be danger there. And I attribute that to a certain level of cultural distance and too much media influence on how
too much media influence. You hit my nail on the head right there.
There you go.
What'd you say, Kenneth?
Yeah, I've been kind of waiting my turn to say it. Media is killing us on that issue. The images that they project of young people to sell product of any kind has been harmful over the last 20 years.
And Kenneth, you're probably on the other side of, by the way, what you were saying when you said all white, you're on the other side of Jay-Z's all black everything. So let's go back to the phones. We have another call here before the end of the hour if we can. June, you're on the air. Junior on the air?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a teacher in Baltimore City Schools, high school, and some of this stuff is true. Well, for one thing, I never saw any integration, and I grew up in Baltimore City Schools. Hmm. In fact, I was poor, so the schools I went to were predominantly black, and it might have been 5 whites in the class, which was fine with me. I still think I got a good education. But now, the sad thing is, Martin Luther King, you know, this was one of the things he gave his life for, was for us to be an integrated society, especially in public education. And, my niece lives with me, and she got lucky and got a scholarship to Roland Park Country School, one of the private schools. And when I go up there, it makes me really depressed to see all the great things that these private schools give these students when every child in public schools should be privy to the same things.
Amen, June. I say all the time on this program and other places that public school students should have the same exact opportunities on every level of our private school students, and they don't. And they don't.
It's unfair because it's, as your other caller said, it's the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And in this society, it's getting it's bigger. It's not going to be a middle, much of a middle left anymore. Mm-hmm. You're either going to be the rich or the poor. And like I try to tell my niece, you know, don't envy them so much, because that was just the luck of the draw. They were born; these kids were born into the rich. I said that doesn't mean that you can't make something of yourself. And in fact, yes.
I'm sorry, we're just about out of time, and I appreciate your call. I think you raised some important issues. This has been a really fascinating discussion. I think we've all had together here.
But just one last thing: all city high schools do not have low test scores. That gentleman was wrong. And I teach at Carver High School in West Baltimore. And we don't have, just because we're not city or poly, we have higher test scores, too.
That's true. I'm glad you raised that point. And June, I'd love to get you on the air with us one day when we have our teachers' roundtables. We'd like to get to the trenches, as I say, and talk to the people who are actually doing the work in our classrooms and hear what they have to say. I think those who make policy also always forget to hear what folks who are really doing the work have to say. Mm-hmm. And I do want to thank our guests right here. This has been great. Dr. Jeff Menzies here from Morgan State University, a psychologist, author of Dumbing Down, Reflections on the Miseducation of the Negro. Jeff, it was great to have you with us. Thank you so much. Please come back.
Hey, appreciate you, Mark.
Kenneth Haynes, president of the Prince George's County Education Association. Man, you were great. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
And thanks for the invite.
Good to have you here. And Dr. Thurman Bridges, associate professor of teacher education here at Morgan State. Thurman, great to meet you. Don't be a stranger.
Won't be. I won't be.
So on the way out, we're going to play a little Richie Havens to take us to the end of the hour. I had the privilege of meeting him in 1965 when I was in college. We hung out a lot. I'll tell you a quick story about it as you listen to this music. When I met him, he went backstage. We talked. He spent 2 hours writing letters to people in jail for us who were in jail on drug charges, marijuana charges most likely, and for people who were serving time in prison for refusing to serve and go to war. And he spent 2 hours of his time there writing letters to them. That's the soul and heart of this man, Richie Havens, that we lost, who was an amazing human being. I had the privilege and honor of interviewing him twice for his book. And when he was here performing in Baltimore, he remembered that story. Didn't remember me, but remembered that story, which is fine. After the night we did afterwards, he wouldn't remember. Who would remember anybody anyway? But he remembered what happened before we started partying. And he was just an amazing human being. So I leave you with Richie Havens. Rest, my brother, rest. It was wonderful to have you among us. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery, Stephanie Marvronis, and Bobby Marvin Holmes. Our engineer tonight is Andrew Holt. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And please join us on our website at steinershow.org to podcast our show and find information about our guests. For Public Radio, to be EAA 88.9 FM. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Bless you, Richie Havens.
I believe I'll go see her again. Nobody's got to guess. Baby can be blessed till she finds out that she's like all the rest, with her fog, her amphetamines, and her pearls. Oh, she takes just like a woman, and she makes a love just like a woman, and she aches just like a woman, but she breaks just like a little girl. From the first, and I was dying there of thirst, so I named it Gia. Long time curse, curse, but what's worse, oh Lord, is this pain in here. I can't stay in here. Ain't it clear that I can't fit?
when we meet again. Introduced as friend, please don't let on that you knew me when I was hungry and it was your world. Are you fake, just like a woman? And you make love just like a woman. And you ache just like a woman. But you break